So today it's stage two, which is the Chittamatta approach. While the Shravaka stage belongs to what is sometimes called the Hinayana, the Chittamatta stage belongs to the Mahayana. Mahayana means the great vehicle because its goal is the great goal of the enlightenment of all beings. These contrasts with the goal of the Hinayana, which is simply the cessation of one's own personal suffering. From the Mahayana point of view, the Hinayana is a true and valid means for removing the self-clinging that gives rise to the unhealthy emotions, the root of all suffering. The Mahayana also accepts that the Hinayana removes the veils of ignorance that prevent one realizing the true nature of the skandhas as no self, in other words, as empty. However, the Mahayana teaches that Hinayana does not remove ignorance completely. It simply removes the gross ignorance that causes klesha and suffering. Technically, it's said to remove simply the veils of afflictions or disturbing emotions, leaving the more subtle veils called the knowledge veils. Klesha and suffering are extinguished like the flame of a candle whose wax is exhausted, and the meditator passes into a state of peace which he calls nirvana. However, the Mahayanist realizes that even in this stage of peace, there is still a subtle kind of ignorance. It is ignorance of the true nature of reality, and this ignorance obscures the fullness of the potential that a human being has. A human being can actually reach a state of perfect and complete awakening in which he is endowed with all the powers of the Buddha. This means all the powers that work for the benefit of all sentient beings and bring them finally to perfect and complete awakening. Thus, the motive for progressing further is compassion for other beings and the wish to remove their suffering. Compassion alone is not enough, however. It's also necessary to have the vision to see that the power to liberate others arises from seeing the true nature of reality more deeply. One has to aspire to remove all one's subtle veils of ignorance and to realize the supreme awakening of the Buddha. These veils of ignorance are called the veils of knowledge, and though subtle, are very powerful. They pervade and distort the way one sees and understands the whole of one's experience and prevent one knowing anything properly in an absolute sense. Thus, the Bodhisattva has two great aspirations. One is to liberate all sentient beings, and the other is to realize the profound emptiness of all phenomena, the realization of the fully awakened Buddha. This double aspiration is called the giving rise to the enlightened mind, with this aspiration as the foundation, one proceeds to the next stage of the meditation on emptiness. Chittamatra means mind only, or merely mind. As at the Shravaka stage, at the Chittamatra stage, one thinks of one's mind as a stream of moments of consciousness with a knowing and a known aspect. However, whereas at the Shravaka stage one takes for granted a world out there beyond the senses, at the Chittamatra stage this is questioned. The Chittamatra doesn't take this view that the world is the Chittamatra does not take a view that the world is his own invention and that nothing exists outside himself. This would be like some kind of madness. He avoids this because he already realizes the emptiness of self. There is no self that could be the creator of such a fantasy world. Essentially, the Chittamatra approach, like any Buddhist approach, is based on direct experience. following the Shravaka pattern of trying to be intimately aware of every moment of consciousness as it arises, at the Chittamatran stage, the meditator realizes that the division of each moment of awareness into an inner perceiving mind and an outer perceived object is a conceptual invention. In a dream, one experiences, moment by moment, inner perceiving moments of consciousness aware of seemingly outer perceived objects. And yet, when one wakes up, one realizes there were no outer perceived objects other than the mind itself. Both the inner perceiving moments of consciousness and the outer perceived objects were different manifestations of mind. This shows that the mere appearance of seemingly outer perceived objects is not any proof that such things exist in absolute terms. In fact, there is no proof that there is any substance other than mind anywhere. Furthermore, the Buddha himself taught the three realms of, stated the following, the three realms of existence are merely mind. Thus, having already established that there is no personal self in the skandhas, the Chittamatri now looks at the skandhas themselves with greater precision. Not only is there no self in the sense of a lasting, separate, independent person, but there is no difference in nature between mind and matter. Matter is empty of a separate, independent nature. Thus, in absolute terms, each moment of experience is empty of a difference in nature of perceiver and perceived. Rather than regarding consciousness merely as the seeing or observing aspect of a moment of experience, it is also the content of that experience. Mind is, at one and the same time, both real and empty. It is real in the sense that all experience is basically a manifestation of mind. It is empty in the sense that it is not a lasting, single, independent entity. It is instead a stream of fleeting, dependently arising moments of consciousness. Furthermore, all phenomena pertain either to the inner perceiving aspect of consciousness or to the outer perceived aspect of consciousness. In other words, they are all mind. So the whole of existence is empty of a duality of substance between mind and matter. This means there are no limits to the power of the mind, and there is no reason why a person should not realize the full powers of the Buddha's enlightenment and work for the liberation of all beings. On reflection, one can see that the Shravaka approach is similar to removing suffering in a dream by recognizing that the person in the dream is not really oneself. The Chittamatra approach is like removing the suffering by realizing that both the cause of the suffering, for example the fire or the tiger, and the person suffering are both nothing more than the play of mind. Realizing that, one realizes that the fire or the tiger and the suffering are empty of any reality of their own. Furthermore, recognizing that it is the mind producing both, one could choose to dream of whatever one wanted to. Not only is one liberated from the illusion of self, one is liberated from the sense of powerlessness. That sense of powerlessness prevents one realizing one's true nature and limits one's capacity to feel compassion. It's important not to take the Chittamatra view to be a kind of... Chittamatra is not saying everything is oneself or one's own personal experience. There is a world that one shares with others. What Chittamatra is saying, however, is that it's not of a different substance to mind. This doctrine is very useful when discussing how a consciousness which is of a mental nature can perceive matter. There is a discontinuity between our experience and what we conceive of as the material world. For example, we experience obstruction and conceive of solidity. We never really experience solidity as such. Solidity can only be imagined by the mind. Solid material things cannot get into the mind and float about in it. Mind cannot put out a kind of a feeler into the material world and experience it. The mind simply experiences mental events and interprets them to mean there is such a thing as a material world with which it then proceeds to imagine. Quite a lot of modern scientists and philosophers think that the mind-matter dichotomy can be resolved by saying that mind is none other than matter. The interesting thing about that theory is that not only does one interpret one's experience to mean that there is a material world beyond the senses, but that that material world can produce and experience thoughts, emotions, and mental images in just the same way that one's own mind does. Furthermore, these thoughts, feelings, and images pertain to the material world. One is left wondering what material might mean in this context. The dream example. The dream example is the best means one has for understanding the citta-matra stage of realizing emptiness. In order to appreciate how this example is, ask yourself how you know that you're not dreaming right now. Maybe you feel like saying, because dreams are never so vivid as these, colors are not so bright, forms, sounds, smells, touch and tastes are not so clear and precise. However, someone else might disagree and say his dreams are even more vivid than his daytime experiences. Does this then make his dreams waking experience and his waking a dream? Does it mean if your faculties become impaired so that you no longer experience things so clearly and precisely that your life becomes a dream? On further reflection, you might suggest that you know that you're not dreaming because of the continuity of your life. Everything is in predictable places. There is a sense of cause and effect, regularity, an established pattern of events, and so on. You might say that dreams are not like that. They are unpredictable. They can change in bizarre ways without warning and for any apparent reason. There is no real continuity, and you might find yourself in any place, time, shape, or form. Are you saying then that if a dream were to stabilize so that there were a continuity and a fairly predictable pattern of events, if then it were to continue for long periods of time and your waking experiences were only to last for brief periods in which you were very confused and disoriented, then the dream would have become waking experience and the waking experience dream? For after all, it's not unusual for people to dream of ordinary situations. For example, that they have got up and had their breakfast and gone to work and so on. You may laugh at the suggestion that you're dreaming now. You may think that if you were asleep and dreaming, everybody would stop interacting with you. They would tell you when you woke up that you had been dreaming. So there is no way that one could confuse dreaming with waking. However, there is no inherent reason why you should not dream that people have woken you up and told you that you have just awakened from a dream. Finally, one has to admit that there is no characteristic of waking experience that clearly distinguishes it from dreaming. It is only a matter of degree and of one's emotional predisposition. You believe you're awake because you want to feel secure and feel that the world is solid, real, and supportive around you. If you were to seriously doubt you were awake, you would feel frightened and confused. The stability of the experience of being awake reassures you, so you believe in it and give it a reality that you do not accord to dreams. If you suffer in a dream, you're happy to let it go when it ends, feeling reassured that it wasn't real anyway. If you suffer in what you call your waking life, you get emotionally involved in it and afford it the status of absolute reality. Citta-matras explain the phenomena of dreaming as the six consciousnesses which usually face outwards to the objects of the senses, dissolving back into the base consciousness, like waves into an ocean. It then starts to move within itself, creating images of subjects and objects that the mind takes to be real and experiences like waking experience. Thus, the citta-matras are not saying there is no difference at all between waking and dream experience, they are saying that the difference is not one of an essential difference in substance. The subjective nature of time. Maybe you're still not convinced. One knows one is awake because time is passing in a regular and predictable manner, so that one can synchronize events with an apparently stable and independent outside world. This is only another function of the stable way in which one's experience is unfolding. In fact, subjectively, time seems to be going fast or slow according to one's mood and situation. As for synchronizing, when events occur together, they are automatically synchronized, and if they do not, one thinks up a reason to explain it. If one can't, one calls it a mystery, and there have been plenty of unsolved mysteries in the history of mankind. There is a story about a man who went to a magician's home and was offered a cup of tea, and he took a sip of it. What he didn't know was that the magician had put a spell in the tea, so no sooner had he put his cup down than he was under the sway of a magical illusion. He took to his horse and rode to the end of the world, where there was a great ocean, so he could go no further. He met a beautiful woman whom he married and by whom he had 3 children. He lived with her happily for 3 years, until falling upon bad times, he was driven to despair and threw himself into the ocean. At that point, the effect of the spell wore off, and he found himself back at the magician's house with his tea still in front of him. So little time had passed that the tea hadn't stopped swirling in the cup after he had put it down. The point is that the impression of time passing and the flow of events does not prove that anything other than the mind itself is creating it. It is well known, for example, that meditators can go into samadhi for hours or weeks at a time, but it doesn't seem to them that any time has passed at all. Absence of consensus. You may want to argue that there must be a world out there that is not mine, or there would be no consensus about what the world was like. We tend to take as real whatever the general consensus of opinion dictates, especially when it coincides with our own experience and opinions. However, consensus is only a matter of degree. We have no means of knowing whether any of us ever sees or experiences anything in exactly the same way as anybody else. At the same time, there is plenty of evidence that we do not see and experience the same thing in the same way. The difference is even more marked when one considers how differently different creatures experience the same thing. Take water, for example. We experience it as something refreshing to drink. We do not normally see it as something to live in. However, fish do. A fish's view on the nature of water is totally at odds with ours. Again, take the example of someone like Mao Zedong. To some, he appeared as a dangerous enemy, and to others, as a dear friend. Yet to a mosquito he appeared just as a source of nourishment, and to the parasites in his body a complete universe. Since for any object its every aspect is established through the perception of the moments of consciousness perceiving it, how can its existence independent of these consciousnesses be established? Consensus doesn't prove anything other than that certain relationships exist between different streams of experience. It doesn't prove that there is anything other than mind in substance. In fact, there are fundamental problems involved in positing the existence of some substance other than mind. How can such a substance be found or known? If something cannot be known without a knower, how can it ever be shown to exist independently? How does the interface between mind and matter actually work? How can matter enter into a relationship with mind, or mind with matter, since the alternative explanation put forward by the Chittamatins dispenses with such problems? It demands serious consideration. This was then a brief explanation on the view of the mind-only school. So if you have questions about it, you can ask now.
Is the usage of the word mind in this case somehow a little bit different than the way that English-speaking people conceive of it? Somewhat, as you said, relative reality is in Tibetan translated as deceptive.
So maybe if you could precise the way in which you think English-speaking people think of mind.
Is there...
Because I would have... He doesn't know how they use it, so I would have to explain that.
We think of mind as intellect, predominantly. Or we think of mind as the sense of I-ness. So it's difficult for us to conceive of the mind as I, creating all these physical objects.
The mind as I?
Right. My mind.
You mean what it's usually conceived
right.
of?
Right. I thought there's another way of thinking of mind.
The sem di kandina, ta sem gitrashi suna.
Sem.
Sem sejite.
Sem sejite. Senki sem se jete sarkin repare. Sarkin ru yorepa. Sarkin yopa. Yon jimbe nyopa yopa teno.
So...
Sarkin repa lo yin te nyese.
Mind has an aspect of clarity and it conceives of objects. So it's a faculty or mind is then has this aspect of clarity in addition to which it perceives or conceives of objects. That's its function.
Then yeah, kap kap so your request he been thing you think your that is like no. Aba chita de sem le yeva mandava tan yang thing you so mandava yo.
Though there are different definitions of what mind is, Rinpoche has then mentioned this one, that it has clarity and it conceives of objects.
Then door dona tanda sanghe, semna sar san san kingda. Sar san san tiye, sar san san tiye, nani, tiye tingi, yoran zimba neba yobati doga, all the same.
So, it has this aspect of clarity and it has the capacity to apprehend objects. Are there other questions?
You didn't answer.
Well, it's a series of lectures that Rinpoche has given in the past. These lectures have been translated and arranged by one of his students. The book then contains five approaches. Yesterday the Sravaka approach was explained, and today Rinpoche will explain the mind-only school, and then later on the other approaches in the book, which belong to, or which are the Svatantrika approach, the Prasangika approach, and the empty of other approach. So in all there are five approaches. So with respect to the mind only school, I read half, because there is an afternoon teaching, so the rest will be read up then, and then you have time in between to think about it.
Mm-hmm. I was so distracted. I
get
one phrase and I couldn't connect it with the next sentence.
Yeah. Morang go kon shida ko tup ma so sem yeng ne. Mm. Nang ma ko man yong ma yisa da ba.
Ah, yeah. Ne.
Lam san ko gi ma ne ni mo
che. Te ne san je je dan dan do le. Ji ja yu se da kam sum bo ne sem sam mo sum.
So the Buddha, addressing his followers, stated that the three realms are merely mind. So the three realms are the realms of desire, form, and no form. certain Hindu traditions assert that these realms are created by an external god such as Ishvara or Brahma. So this is then refuted by the Buddha, stating that these realms are merely mind. Mental projections. These realms are not the creation of an external god such as Ishvara, Brahma, or Indra. They are merely mind, according to the Buddha. Furthermore, these three realms did not realms did also not arise from no cause or condition at all, as if they would have arisen out of nothing. So these three realms also didn't arise without a cause or condition. So these three realms are mind, mental projections. So by this statement, it is shown that these three realms are the expression of a confused mind.
Then
which amounts to saying that they are karmic manifestations.
So, independence
upon fully aroused ignorance, virtuous and unvirtuous karma is accumulated. In relation to karma, there are then predispositions. Predispositions are accumulated. Due to the power of these predispositions, then various appearances or manifestations are experienced. So, in dependence upon these predispositions, then various experiences arise, which then arise out of confusion or due to a confused mind. For example, if one considers the flowers on the shrine, these flowers are perceived in different ways by different beings. And if one considers the body of one person, that same body is perceived in different ways by different beings. So the fact that one and the same thing is perceived differently by different beings indicate that what is perceived arises due to karma, arises due to a confused state of mind.
So, what
is experienced is mental appearances. The appearances are of a mental nature, mental projections. The best example to illustrate this is the example of a dream.
So,
in the dream state, a variety of appearances are dreamt of. These are merely mind, are mental projections. From the point of view of the essence of the objects dreamt of, there is no true existence. They have no true existence whatsoever.
So one should then
analyze and examine the appearances in a dream in order to understand that they have no external existence. They are not truly truly existent objects. They are merely mind. So whatever one experiences, whether it is happiness or sorrow, in either case, there is nothing but mind. There is nothing existent apart from mind, independently from mind. So it's quite easy to understand that such feelings are merely mind. In addition to that, one must understand that the causes and conditions that produced these feelings are also merely mind.
Right. This is not that. Yeah, but that's
So one should then consider the statement of the Buddha that everything is merely mind and reflect upon the reasons for why everything is merely mind. So, Rinpoche says that you can now continue to ask about the mind-only school in relation to what was read up and what he just said.
The Quran.
Yes.
Like some of the truths that the Rinpoche is telling us now, where did they come from? I mean,
some of the what?
The truths and the statements that we were just read, where do they come from? There has to be some consensus. I mean, I hope I'm not hearing that things are like a dream, and someone else is hearing that things are solid. So there has to be some sort of consensus. There is something going into my mind, but it's coming from somewhere else, I think. And I'm not sure I understand this.
So what you want to know is, or what you say you believe is that things that you hear and understand must come from somewhere external to you.
Right.
That's what you
want
to ask.
And also there has to be, I hope, some sort of consensus.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you know, we'd be hearing totally different things. Life is like a dream. Life is totally solid and materialistic.
You mean that if there is no consensus, a group of people couldn't hear the same thing, though one thing is said?
Right. Everything you were reading, everyone would be hearing differently. Now,
Koran samna da deb lo du dang digi lo shakwa digi kola samlo tang du tene si ne yong pa rabu tik dus deb lo pa dang digi ko wa rabu si ne yong wa rabu tik dus koran samna.
Yore thing as a melange capsule here, tragic tuna, that is sent to Pandavati.
Yeah, well, with respect to the first part, it seems to one that things come to one from an external world. If you dream that you hear a sound, in the dream it seems to you that the sound is external to you.
Arre, te carre sana. Nam he doesn't say Ninan Hyayon, the Turbadi Hyayon, the Ninan Hyayore. Ninan Hyayon, the Niabanamaji Hyayon, the Nedrati Yinion Namahyagre.
So, if one considers a confused state of mind, then in terms of such a state of mind, there is the experience of subject and object as two separate things. So, when you dream that you hear a sound, it seems to you that the sound is external to you. So that type of experience, dualistic experience, is said to be a confused type of experience because in actual fact there is no such duality. So you may also dream that you see something, a visual form. Then it seems to you that the form is separate from yourself. That you who perceive is separate from what is perceived. In addition to that, there is the tendency to further solidify this duality. One has the tendency to reinforce that type of duality. So in addition to this seeming duality, it is reinforced due to a confused state of mind.
Okay.
Are there other questions? Yes.
When one realizes emptiness, do appearances cease to exist?
You mean you would no longer see and hear things? Tōngi tōna.
Tōngi tōna.
Tēne nāngwā gā rōgen rūgē.
Tēre tāndā tē kēpān tō. Tāndā tē tōngi ngā yorobā, rāpā ngā hī yorobā. Tēle tāvē kēpān tō.
Well, that's differently viewed by different approaches.
Then it's your tongue among the Senna. I don't need to know. You talk to now and now and then go to my.
Generally speaking, with respect to the realization of emptiness, then in the post meditational phase, appearances would not cease. De chetu gakpa mare rangshin gi gadoba
rangshin gi gadoba
de tongyu me pa nyenju me pa re ro gindu ge
re tela tanda semsan ji lo da umal lo semsan ji lo umal lo la rang tong lo yin tong lo ge che pa ya
yeah as Rinpoche said in the beginning it depends on the tradition how this is viewed. So there is the mind-only school, then there is the empty of self approach, empty of other approach, and so forth. They view this differently, whether or not appearances cease.
Arre. Arre, arre. Then it's your answer, and I did.
So, what would you, so to speak, prefer yourself, that things cease to exist or not?
Well, it would be nice to phase them in and phase them out.
What do you mean by that?
Well, during meditative stabilization, it would be nice to be able to phase them out.
Not to be bothered by them, you mean?
Or see their transparent nature, or to have them appear in some fundamentally different way.
Yena gagindu de hinayang chirtang gi want to nagna yafumindus. Da nang shimpa tongpa yimpa dago chik nagna yafumusares.
Ore, malang wa shimpa dago chik chong yafumusares.
So. Would it be good if appearances would appear to one as appearances would in the dream state where one had recognized that one is dreaming?
I like
that. What did I do?
According to the mind-only school, while one rests in meditative equipoise or a state free from mental fabrications, then appearances are not experienced, whereas they are experienced in the post-meditational phase.
Jetan Sanji, the two times the Juman Tabu, Malam Tabu song yore, don't tamp them, but when some to talk, they talk to now and then Malam Tabu, Juman Tabu.
So the Buddha has stated that appearances are dreamlike and illusion like. If one directly realizes the ultimate truth, then appearances in the post meditational phase will be experienced as dreamlike and illusion like.
Then you talk to now Juman Tabu, and then Barry came by. Dembari Hemba Mahina,
So, if there is such realization as was said, then appearances in the post-meditational phase will be experienced as illusion-like. Therefore, there is no apprehension of them as truly existent, which results in that one doesn't suffer anymore.
Yeah, come on.
Yes.
If you reach it this way, depending on different schools too, but if you reach the point where you're not differentiating between meditation and post-meditation states, when meditators achieve no difference between meditation and post-meditation, how do appearances appear to him in the mind only school and also in the empty of self school?
De ñam cha dan je top ni la che par me pa ina to pa to empu la pep ne che pa me pa ina te ne nang wa de so khang gi go ne khan ra nyong gi ore sem sam gi want to say na dan dan tong gi want to say na
ore te do do la ñam ya ji top la ye ba me pa te
According to the sutra tradition, only the Buddha, or only for a Buddha, would there be no difference between the state of formal meditation and the post-meditational phase.
Tene sajja chenpu lo la, tene sajja semjine lo ngonsum to tobu namjor pala tene
But according to the Mahamudra tradition, then great yogis that have directly realized the true nature of mind, for them there would be no difference between these two phases.
Can you say that in the Lola? Get up the Nama Mangapa, come that over the Tisela Saja Chimbu Tontona Yapoeza.
So according to the Mahamudra tradition, when one has, well, with respect to the post-meditational phase, there is no need to try to intentionally obstruct the experience of appearances. So it's kind of a positive approach. That means that one would be able to incorporate meditation in whatever one does. So, if one has work to do, one could meditate while doing that. So, by that one can actually make one's work into the practice of meditation or the Dharma. So if one is eating, one could meditate while eating.
So
when one experiences afflictions and suffering, one could also use that experience and, so to speak, transform it into meditation. And if one is able to do that, then afflictions and suffering are no obstructions to one's practicing the Dharma. In fact, they are an aid to one's practice. So, in the context of practicing Mahamudra, then one would be able to practice even during sleep. So if one is able to meditate during sleep, it means that one would rest within the luminosity or clarity of mind, which would be a rather pleasant experience.
So
So, in actual fact, ultimately, one must realize Mahamudra. But Mahamudra is very difficult to realize at once in the when one starts out in the practice of meditation. Therefore, one should go through and practice the various stages that have been mentioned and will be mentioned. So, Rinpoche in 78, for the first time, explained these five approaches mentioned in the book. At that point, a smaller booklet was published. It has now been enlarged, and we have this present booklet, which Rinpoche says he has taught these various stages of meditation on emptiness as a preliminary practice or a basis for the practice of Mahamudra. So, some people then are not very interested in, for example, deity practice. They do not like to visualize a deity, recite a mantra, and so forth. Others then are not interested in meditating on the on repulsiveness, as is done in the Shravaka path. Some people do not like to meditate on blue deities, and others do not like red deities, and so forth. So people have various likes and dislikes. Therefore, Rinpoche taught these progressive stages of meditation on emptiness. They do not involve any visualization of a deity and so forth, and they do not involve contemplating repulsiveness and so forth. The practices of meditation presented in the book are then related to philosophical tenets, and so Rinpoche hopes and thinks that it would be a type of meditation which would appeal to a majority of people interested in meditation. So the source is the word of the Buddha, and the practices, the meditations on emptiness, are then related to different philosophical tenets. Then if one is not able to develop one's practice of meditation to a refined state or stage, so to speak, at least in dependence upon these progressive stages, one acquires a knowledge of different philosophical tenets. So even though one may have difficulties with meditation practice, one will develop a knowledge of the different philosophical tenets. So then, in the first part of the book, meditation on individual selflessness is explained. Those teachings are shared by the Shravaka approach and the Mahayana. So if one first understands that there is no truly existent individual self, That understanding will facilitate an understanding of the mind-only school, which teaches that everything is merely mind. So if one in the first place has not understood that there is no truly existent individual self, then it will be very difficult to understand that what one experiences as the external world in fact is merely mind, a mental projection. For example, in the dream state, when not being aware of that there is no real individual self, then one will attach reality to or conceive of appearances dreamt of as real, not having understood that in the first place there is no truly existent perceiver.
ngarang tambo nga samba namto ji cha de ngarang mene ni samba de bar chen ba yore tele te ne ngam an phong ma nyong ba te long ba te mene de ba re sa ne sem ko
to so if one dreams that one ends up in an empty place, an empty valley, for example, where there are no people, where there are no other people, then one starts out relating to oneself as a person or an individual. One thinks, I have arrived in this empty place, and one conceives of oneself as real and solid. In dependence upon that, one will conceive of the surroundings as real and solid as well.
So during the dream
then, when one has ended up in this empty place, as was said, one thinks that one is real and solid, in addition to which one thinks or conceives of the surroundings as real and solid. One is confused to the point where one doesn't even ask oneself, how come that I ended up here?
The jumpsin the karasana takte tamaki pate na da rani la dembare kembo wangetene.
So one becomes confused or is confused because one conceives of oneself as real and solid to the extent that one doesn't even ask oneself how come I ended up here. One doesn't even try to examine the situation.
So if one has
understood that in fact one isn't real nor solid, then when ending up in this empty place, one would examine the situation, asking oneself, how come that that I ended up here, and so forth. So one would examine the situation.
Mananji nama yendo chu tamche semtang yinpar xina, semtang yinpar xina, tina oma rangtong tato chu tamche rangka ngobu mato pata yang to le la wye.
Milam kanto shinto?
Semtang tanda xie song?
La re yinna milam shinto?
Mananji yendo nama de semtang yinpar xina.
So if one understands that all appearances are merely mind, as appearances that one dreams of, then that will facilitate an understanding of the empty of self approach. Since if everything is merely mind, it indicates that phenomena wouldn't constitute a self-entity or a self-essence. It indicates that they are empty of true existence, empty of a self-entity. So with respect to the empty of self approach, there are two subdivisions, these Svatantrikas and Prasangikas. If one understands and realizes that phenomena are empty of a self-entity or a self-nature, that will facilitate an understanding of the fifth approach, the empty of other approach. In that approach, one speaks of wisdom free from mental fabrications. An understanding of that wisdom will then facilitate an understanding of Mahamudra. So, therefore, these five approaches are like the basis for Mahamudra. Are there other questions?
Yes.
When one experiences emptiness of self, emptiness of other, that is temporary too. That experience itself is temporary too.
Pena rang tongi lula, rang rang ngogo gi tongpe nyam nyong chung na, nyam nyong de yang lo burwa, rebe?
Nyam nyong te?
No, tempo.
Re, te tempo ma re, nyam si jite yang yo lo re.
Well, an experience is always
rang
unstable.
Rang tong lo re.
An experience is always unstable.
Always unstable.
Rang tong lo re.
Da rang tong shen tong ka re, nyam nyong de. Yeah, experiences always change. So generally speaking, there are three things, intellectual understanding, experience, and realization. So intellectual understanding arises in dependence upon verbal explanations and analysis. An intellectual understanding can perish very easily if this understanding is not applied in the practice of meditation. It vanishes very easy.
Tene nyamnyong seje te magom na tuba tanje nyamnyong mare gom na nyamnyong yungre ina ya nyamnyong te.
So, experience mainly arises in relation to the practice of meditation. If one doesn't apply what one has understood by listening to the teachings in the practice of meditation, then there will be no experience. And experience itself, as was said, is of a changing nature. If one doesn't develop continuity in one's practice, the experience will vanish, will disappear. With respect to the empty of other approach, empty of self approach and Mahamudra, When there is direct realization, then what has been directly realized, or that realization itself, does not disappear. Mm-hmm. In terms of direct realization, this direct realization wouldn't vanish or disappear. It's stable. So one needs to directly realize the true nature. That realization wouldn't vanish. Until one has directly realized the true nature, up to that point, one must apply oneself to various methods by means of which one arrives at direct realization. Having direct realization, it wouldn't matter very much what one does. One could spend one's time sleeping, for example. It wouldn't change anything. Because at that point one would be able to meditate during sleep. It's also okay not to sleep. One could just rest within the true nature of mind, the luminous nature of mind also. So it doesn't matter much what one does at that point. So if one is struck by suffering at that point, wouldn't matter either. It would be an aid to one's practice. It would reinforce one's realization.
So heightened neurosis, what's that, we're talking about, would be an aid to one's practice. Mm-hmm.
Sen kipume payang nyamlingi choreve.
Because the contrast sometimes just seems to be so strong between, you know, experiencing emptiness at times through the exertion of practice, and then just complete depression,
mm-hmm.
or just
mm-hmm.
sadness. Or,
you mean in the case of having no direct realization?
Mm-hmm.
Of an ordinary practitioner, you mean?
Myself.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
An ordinary mm-hmm. practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Just my own experience
mm-hmm.
of the contrast
of, between these two.
Between,
yeah.
you know, bouncing from
mm-hmm.
experience of some quality of emptiness through the exertion of practice, and then complete impatience.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I know that before he said that these things are accidents.
Uh-huh. Tene so so ki we want to say na tene samsang gom gyab du ta thong ni gin yam yong den de yong ge ba tene samsam yang sem ki po me pa la so pa kangal den de yong ge ba de ni ki pa shi da yo de so so ki we want to say na nyam yong gi want to say na ki pa shi da yong ge du
sem ki po me pa ta
dang
tong yi gi nyam nyong pena o yong gre te ma gom ben nyam nyong da gom ben nyam nyong de ne che ba chira yong
ma
gom
ben nyam
ma la ngo ma chi ben nyam ngo ma chi ben nyam nyong da ngo chi ben nyam nyong che ba chira yong gre te la ma gi nyam nyong che ba den
da ho re
re re yin dai
sa
ti yin dai
so Rinpoche again gives the example of the dream state. There is a big difference with respect to one's experience in the dream state in relation to whether one has recognized that one is dreaming or not. So that difference is applicable to the difference between the two states you mentioned. If one is aware of that one is dreaming, then if one dreams of being burnt in a fire, carried off by a flood, or that a poisonous snake coils itself around one's body, no, one wouldn't experience any fear in relation to either of the, in relation to any of these events, since one is aware of that one is dreaming.
So that
recognition results in an open and spacious state of mind, whereas if there is no recognition of the dream for what it is, then one would experience difficulties, one would suffer greatly.
So passionlessness, for that point, passionlessness, open state of mind.
Mm-hmm. And then? If one doesn't conceive of what is experienced in the dream as real and solid, then one will be in an open and spacious state of mind. So if one has no attachment to what's occurring, there would be an open and spacious state of mind. So similarly, in the waking experience, when one has thoughts of attachment, when one apprehends whatever is experienced as real and solid, then there is no open and spacious state of mind. So if one considers a very influential person, such as a president or the richest person in the world, for example, these persons, if they had no apprehension of reality as real and solid, they wouldn't suffer. But such persons, in spite of their influence, wealth, and so forth, seem to suffer, and they suffer because they conceive of reality as real and solid. So siddhas of the past have, many of the siddhas of the past have said that poor people usually have more physical pain, and wealthy and influential people usually have more mental pain. So a poor person, if a poor person is given a nice bed to sleep in and a nice meal, he would sleep there with a full stomach happily. His problems would be gone, so to speak. Whereas in the case of an influential or wealthy person, that's not sufficient. This person, even though he or she has a nice bed and can sleep there with a full stomach, that person suffers anyway, because his problem or her problem is mainly mental pain. If one considers phenomena or suffering in this way, one will come to see that in fact both phenomena and suffering are but mind, they are mental projections. So the most important thing in the beginning is to understand that suffering is merely mind. So now we will meditate a bit.
Give one day, give one day.
Yeah, that's